general relativity conformally coupled to a scalar field. And yeah, as already mentioned, this was work with Norbert and Andreas. And yeah, so the main content of the talk will be the following. First, I will describe the gauge fixing and unfixing perspective, on which gives some sort of a dual picture to these linking theories we already heard about, Tim and Enrique. And then I will give an application of this to general relativity and matter using these ideas of shape dynamics, where you trade one symmetry for another. And yeah, then I will come to sort of the quantum part, where we, or it's still classical, so we define variables which have simple conformal transformation behavior. So under this, so we also trade the Hamiltonian constraint for this local conformal constraint. And yeah, the issue is finding good variables for that constraint so that you actually can solve it. And so, and this is what we then call the partially reduced phase space quantization, because we only reduce with respect to the local conformal transformations. And I will also show how you can extend this to standard model matter, at least if you assume that your matter actions are conformally invariant. And yeah, you can also include something like cosmological constant and certain potentials, which do not need to be conformally invariant. And yeah, and then at the last point, I will give possible applications of this quantization and comment on open problems. And so this is then the outline in more detail. So in part one, I just comment on the gauge unfixing and the role of observables and how you can trade dynamics in these pictures. So the outset will be that we have a totally constrained first class irreducible system. And yeah, so we have constraints h of n and n vector, which should remind you of the Dirac algebra, and they will, in section two, become the Dirac algebra. And then we further assume, as in that case, splitting of the constraints in one which, and one scalar part and one vector part of the constraints. And we introduce gauge conditions for the scalar part of the constraints. And well, as you all know, this is just that the Poisson bracket gives an invertible operator on the gauge cut. And furthermore, we have to assume that the gauge conditions are invariant, so that they are preserved by the not fixed part of the constraint, so later on the spatial diffeomorphisms. And the additional structure one can require, as we already learned, is that the gauge fixing conditions themselves also form a first class algebra, and this will be later on the generator of conformal transformations, or local conformal transformations. But in contrast to shape dynamics, we will use the full set of local conformal transformations, not only the volume preserving ones. And then the crucial observation is that the gauge fixing condition tells you that essentially the original set of constraints and the one where you trade the scalar constraint or the gauge fixing conditions just define the same reduced phase space, at least locally. As in shape dynamics, I cannot really give a full account on the global structures involved here. So, and then the conclusion seems to be that you can trade H invariance for the D invariance of the system. And if you have simpler structure functions for the gauge conditions, for example, you have just structure constants, as in the case where you look at local conformal transformations, then you can use this to simplify the gauge algebra. And so you can just use D, so the gauge fixing constraints and the vector constraints as new constraints of your system. But yeah, coming from, say, the ADM perspective, there is also the problem that gauge symmetry is only one part of the story. You also have to consider observables. And yeah, so we will use the notion of Dirac observables, and I will introduce H and D observables, which just means that you consider observables with respect to the first system of constraints, and observables with respect to this one where you traded the scalar constraint for the gauge fixing condition. And now the trading of observables is something, at least if you want to consider everything from the viewpoint of the original theory in terms of the H constraints, that these observables carry, well, your interpretation of the system and the dynamical content of the theory. So, and one way to get from the original system to the new system would be that you construct a map between these observables. And this can be done, in at least in some more or less formal way, by the use of partial observable projectors. We indicated some references, so there are a lot of people which have already thought about this. And what you do is just you consider functions on the reduced phase space and construct a one-to-one correspondence with their gauge invariant extensions to the respective first class surface, which is defined by the D of set of D constraints or H constraints. So, and this provides these maps P, where the notation indicates that the lowercase h, for example, in the first map that you project on H observables with respect to the gauge condition D. And the explicit construction of these projectors then can be given in terms of a least formal power series for field theories for systems with finite degrees of freedom. You can give this as a converging power series, at least in some examples. And in shorthand notation, this is just acting with the flow with respect to which you want gauge invariance on the respective observable you want to consider. And where you have to evaluate the phase space flow is determined by the Dirac matrix and the gauge condition. So, and this allows you to construct D observables from H observables. And in fact, these projectors are weak Poisson isomorphisms. That is, they map the weak Dirac observables with the induced Poisson structure to exactly the corresponding algebra on the other side. But there's a possible caveat here, namely, that you can only apply this formula if the constraints you used for the extension are first class. And if you want to consider, for example, the projector on the H observables, you cannot give this in terms of this explicit formula. So it exists in an abstract way. But the problem is that this explicit parameterization does not work because the scalar constraints themselves are not first class, so they always commute to diffeomorphism. And you could overcome this if you also introduce gauge conditions for the diffeomorphism constraints. Yeah?
But the natural thing at that point is to realize the scalar constraints.
Yeah, but the problem is, at least how this formula works, that you always need to abelianize them, you need a system which is first class among themselves. But here you would like to abelianize only the scalar constraints.
But if you take the version for scalar constraints, the conformal factor given the reference section is equal to the solution of the Michelin equation, then at least for CMC polyability, this is an abelian description of the constraint, of the scalar constraint.
Yeah, but perhaps this is this holds only at the point where you can, at the gauge cut, but you need it or always in a neighborhood of the gauge cut, and this could be the problem in that case. So, and because of that, somehow if you do this trading with this map P, the inversion, so going back from D observables to H observables seems difficult because you cannot parameterize this projector map. And I also want to emphasize the role of the gauge flows here, at least from a picture of the original system, namely that if you have a totally constrained system, then the dynamics contained in this system is just unfolding of this gauge flow. And especially with respect to the original system, the dynamics is contained in the H gauge flow. And if you completely fix the H constraints, which you do not do in shape dynamics, then the D gauge flow is just a gauge theoretical description of initial data. So, and but what you could do is try to extract dynamics from this somehow formal expression where you try to treat the gauge condition as a clock variable for the scalar constraint. And this is somewhat explicitly realized in this deparametrizing models, where you solve some of the scalar constraints for some clock momentum, and then the remaining part in the scalar constraints is what becomes your effective Hamiltonian with respect to that clock variable. So, and what you could try to do is perform such a deparametrization on the part of the H observables, and then via these projector maps map that the evolution induced by the effective Hamiltonian to the D observables. So in this, in general, would be quite hard because of the formal power series involved there for the projector maps, but yeah, you could try to make sense out of them. And an alternative to using these deparametrizations could be that you give a construction principle on the level of the D observables, but this is so far unclear, at least to us. Or you try, you could try to find some perturbative methods to evaluate these power series for the projector maps. So in sections two, I describe how this works for gravity conformally coupled to a scalar field. And yeah, so coming to the motivation, now in this section, the original H algebra is just the Dirac algebra, and a D is the generator of local conformal transformations. And one way you could view this is, yeah, we try to quantize shape dynamics. This was something pointed out to us by Sean Gripp. Workshop last fall, namely that you need for this for the quantization of shape dynamics, you need variables which have nice transformation behavior with respect to these local conformal transformations. And one thing why this is difficult, for if you consider this from the loop quantum gravity perspective, you could try to introduce Ashtekar variables for this system. But because of the affine part of the connection, the transformation behavior with respect to the local conformal transformations is quite complicated. And one way out of it would be finding conformally invariant variables to, from which you then construct the Ashtekar connection and its conjugate momentum. And another motivation would be that you, that this mechanism allows you to eliminate the Hamiltonian constraint, at least at the level of gauge symmetries. So, and since one of the problems in the ADM formulation and loop quantum gravity and I think all of quantum gravity is an effective treatment of the Hamiltonian, you could use the ideas from shape dynamics to just eliminate it at this level and via that get access to the state space of physical states. So, and the important observation now is that the metric variables you have in ADM have non-trivial conformal weights, so they are not invariant, but you could couple a matter field that has also non-trivial weight and then construct compound variables which actually transform invariantly under these local conformal transformations. And yeah, let me also remind you that you then still have to check whether this conformal generator still acts as a gauge fixing for the complete system. So we know that from the work in shape dynamics that you can do it, and also from the conformal methods for using the initial value problem, and that you can use the conformal generator on the metric variables as the local gauge fixing for vacuum ADM. And also if you couple matter fields with zero conformal weight, but here we want to use another conformal generator, namely one that also transforms the certain field variable which we covered. And yeah, we use this action for the model, namely just the standard conformally coupled scalar field with gravity. And yeah, we observe that the matter part of this action is actually invariant if you rescale the metric by appropriate conformal factor and also the field. And typically, you can relate them by this dimension-dependent factor. And if you do the d plus 1 split of this action, you get the typical form. And yeah, the h and h vector, again, generate the usual hypersurface deformation algebra.
So is this the same as the action that Bars was talking about yesterday?
Probably, yes.
Yeah.
But he's using just once.
Yeah.
Right.
And okay. You're not using the ghost.
No.
Only.
Well, but he has the full metric, so
yes,
that
yes.
One is still just living in the metric.
Yeah.
Okay.
So and when what you can do then is introduce as gauge condition the generator on conformal generator on the metric field variables and also on the scalar field variables. And since the coupling is not minimal in this model for the conformal scalar, you observe that if you actually write out the conjugate momentum for the metric and the conjugate momentum for the scalar field, you just reobtain the CMC condition if you impose this. You impose this as a gauge fixing condition. So, and in the sense, this again amounts to a choice of a maximal hypersurface. And if you also want to use this condition as a time function for your system, then you would also require CMC foliability. So, and then if you work out the Dirac matrix, you obtain the following form, namely, you get one part which is proportional to the original scalar constraint, one part to the conformal, proportional to the conformal generator, and the and one quadratic form which corresponds to an elliptic partial differential operator, where this p is a certain combination of the field variables, but contains no derivative terms on the Laplace function anymore. So and yeah.
So is it right to say this is sort of analogous to what is doing? You introduce a kind of matter field and then you have a particular gauge fixing for that.
Yeah,
which feels
in a sense, but we.
It's a different matter field, it's a different gauge fixing.
Yeah, but we do not, we somehow do not try to deparameterize the system, but.
Yeah, I mean, if you just got those one slide back, you see that this, but yeah, you see number 17 is the difference. In Carr's work, this would be
exactly
not zero.
So, but we also go in the end go to a reduced phase-based description of this model.
Yeah.
So, and yeah, if you check the invertibility of this Dirac matrix, this amounts to, assuming that this differential operator is invertible, or the Laplace function, and we can actually show this if we assume, for example, the dominant energy condition on the scalar field. And yeah, so then you just have to show that this zero order part of the differential operator is strictly positive, and you get by a quite simple argument just partially integrating the Laplacian there that this operator is actually invertible. And now, since we know that this is at least locally a good gauge fixing, we can perform various conformal canonical transformations to arrive at variables which are actually invariant. So, but there's one drawback here. We also have to require that our scalar field we coupled is actually of dilaton type. So we assume that phi is now something like e to the phi. But then we can perform these canonical transformations So where we just rescale the metric variables with a certain power of this dilaton field or dilaton type field, and we end up with invariant metric variables. And we also change the canonical conjugate momentum of this dilaton type field to the generator of the conformal transformations. So, and the point why we require this dilaton type field are the opposite weights of conformal weights of the metric variables. Because of this, you always need, if you rescale Q by one power, you always need the inverse power for P, and this is why you need essentially a positive field. And now the solution to the conformal constraints are quite simple. You just drop the field variables after this canonical transformation and end up with invariant metric and invariant momentum. And from these, now you can construct invariant connection variables, but for example, along the lines of Ashtika and Barbero, or if you want to go to higher dimensions, there was recent work by Andreas Norbert and Thomas Thiemann. So, but you still, again, pick up this immediate ambiguity here, because this is inherent to the, I mean, you can just yet now rescale with this, with an immediate parameter your Q and P variables, and again, get this ambiguity. So, and remark here is that these canonical transformations, they did not really depend on imposing this gauge fixing. So you could also try to use this in formulating the H observables. And if you had access to an explicit formula for this P, then you would actually expect that you get simple brackets for the projections of the invariant metric and momentum. And since they are already capturing all information which you need for the D observables, and this P is a Poisson isomorphism between your observable algebra on the D side and that on the H side, these already capture all relevant information, and you can again drop the scalar field variables in that picture. So, and if you stick to these Ashtika variables, then you can employ a loop quantization of these variables and actually obtain the physical Hilbert space, namely, similar to what we heard before, you just get the gauge and diffeomorphism invariant spin networks. And now you could try to obtain physical spectra of observables or solve non-dynamical problems in this setting. Because we do not have here, the non-dynamical refers to the fact that we do not have a natural candidate in this setting for the Hamiltonian, at least not one that we can just write down. I mean, there would be one which is just the projection, the observable projection of the one one would get with respect to this gauge fixing condition as a clock variable, but this is rather complicated expression. So this is essentially the same as what happens in shape dynamics. Yeah. I mean, this is just the Hamiltonian which evolves with respect to D as the clock variable. But you would like to transport it to the D observables, and this is quite a mess. So, but what would be the interpretation of this D observables then if you just work in this reduced phase space? Well, they just give their spectrum would give the measurements of the corresponding classical observable at this fixed time D, which is defined by this maximal hypersurface. And as I said already, the implementation of the dynamics is so far not worked out, but at least you have a clear geometric picture of what this time function D would do. So, and in section 3, I want to outline how you can incorporate also other standard matter fields, which is quite nice because this makes the formalism quite flexible. And what you have to consider are conformally invariant matter field actions. And if you do so, this looks schematically like this. So you have some D plus one split of a matter field action, and this C constraints would amount to further gauge transformations on the field variables. And now the conformal generator then picks up a conformal weight, which corresponds to the actual transformation behavior of these field variables. But you observe that the form of the Dirac matrix in this case remains unchanged. And also the invertibility of the Dirac matrix follows along the same lines. So, and what you can then do is, for example, include Young-Mills fields, at least in four space-time dimensions, or here d equals 3, because there you can impose conformal weight 0, and you don't even pick up some contribution to your gauge fixing condition. And the same works for fermions, where we would also use spatial half densities, which we also heard in the talk before, are quite useful. And they then have, again, conformal weight 0, and there comes no contribution to the gauge fixing condition. Yeah?
There's a separate reason we didn't write it in the paper, but the densities are necessary
for the,
to decouple the constraints. Otherwise, otherwise, you get a horrible mess of if you don't use half densities.
And it's also quite natural from the loop variables, because you do not pick up a complex contribution in this case to the connection.
Why do you say that? Why do you mean?
If you want to do the shape dynamics, then it's
okay. That's different. No, I thought of the construction of the action.
In the action you can choose whatever you want.
Okay.
Here it's only quite natural from the, if you now want again to use Ashtika variables, because then you do not, if you use half densities, you do not pick up a complex term and you're still in the setting of a compact gauge group and can do the procedure.
Young-Mills is conform harmonic classically, so how does this
This is only at the classical level at this moment, so.
You want to quantize, right? That's where you were going. You're doing the
quantization. You would also, at least in this setting, you would also use similar construction for the Young-Mills field as for the Ashtika connection. So, and
I mean, the other symmetry, for the fermions or for the conformally coupled scalar, that remains the symmetry even at the quantum level. So, it makes sense. In that case, it's something you will have to give at some point.
Yeah, but the point is that the quantization you would use in this setting for the Young-Mills field there, it's quite, it would need to be investigated. I mean, it's not clear how that quantization relates to the standard quantization procedure for the Young-Mills field.
I want to raise this issue in the discussion.
Okay.
But is it the, you would want to complete the theory in such a way that it is conformally invariant?
I mean, there are superdirected theories for which there is one way. So there are examples. There are examples of superdirected theories in which there is no problem.
Sure, I understand, but I didn't know that you were trying to go much for supersymmetric or highly supersymmetric theory. I thought that this was an attempt to describe non supersymmetric.
And there are also two issues, right? The one issue is the conformal anomalies, and the other issue is the beta functions. And this theory has, even in flat space, has a beta function. Even before you perform the gravity, so unless you arrange so that all beta functions vanish, it looks too much conformal.
Okay.
I mean, the beta function probably doesn't make sense here, because in the end you're doing an orthogonal quantization. You're using something like you're using basically the quantum gravity construction also for the other gauge fields, and then you have non-linear Fock representation, which is not your standard Fock representation. Therefore, you have to say what you mean by beta function there. So it's a different conversation.
I would give a different answer, but let's keep that for the discussion. This is really an important issue that I've.
Okay. So, but at least this somehow tells you that at this classical level, so it's, the formalism is quite flexible, so you can include various methods. So, yeah, there's also the question of potentials, and you can also add potential to your scalar field in the action, but then you find that you can, at least with the in the way we did it so far, you can only conclude the that you can actually include an arbitrary potential if the contribution to this zero order part of your differential operator still gives you strict positivity of that part. But yeah, we just checked it for something like a Higgs potential, and there if you are in greater than three spatial dimensions, you actually pick up the correct sign for that contribution and you can include it on that level. So, and if you want to include a cosmological constant, then you have to extend your gauge fixing condition. And this was also something which Tim pointed out to us. And you just, you go to the, not to a maximal hyperslice, but to hyperslice with a certain prescribed extrinsic curvature. And this will then allow you to include an arbitrary cosmological constant. So you just have to fix the correct value of this parameter delta. And this is just because if you include a cosmological constant, this is somewhat the same as including a potential for the scalar field, but it's just a constant term. So this is why this is actually, you could also absorb this into the potential. And if you do so, you get again contribution to a zero order part of the differential operator. And but this time it picks up, at least for certain values of the cosmological constant, the wrong sign if you do not extend the gauge fixing condition. But if your parameter delta fulfills this inequality, then you're still fine. So let me now come to the last point, possible applications and open problems. So applications would so far be only to non-dynamical problems. So for example, you could compute spectra of observables and, for example, do this for the geometric operators, but they somehow acquire a slightly different interpretation, because symbolically you have something like that your invariant operator is a rescaling of the operator which you obtain in the original metric variables. And the same happens for the volume operator. And what you actually quantize in the end is the invariant part. So if you say that the actual geometric information is in the original part, then this just tells you that certain combinations of the scalar field and the geometric operators with respect to the original variables are quantized. So in that sense, if you want to speculate, you could assume that you have a non-vanishing expectation value for the scalar field, and then this might increase the fundamental scale on the geometric operators, because you have essentially invariant operators are in this setting dimensionless, and you can re-express the geometric operators then with respect to these invariant ones and the scalar field. And another one, another application would be the black hole state counting. So that you can, for example, use this isolated horizon framework, which was applied in loop quantum gravity. And this was also extended to conformally coupled scalar fields, at least on the level of the classical formulas. And I think there were also some quantum computations. And yeah, you can essentially do that, but what happens is that your entropy, because of the non-minimal coupling of the scalar field, also gets a contribution from the that also gets a contribution from the scalar field on the horizon. So, and what is also interesting is that you can, for example, try to analyze some black hole solutions with non-trivial horizon topologies, and for example, also in locally asymptotically ADS spacetimes. So these asymptotically ADS spacetimes, at least it seems at this point, that you can include into this framework. Because so far I've only talked about spacetimes which have compact spatial slice. Yeah.
Question?
Yeah.
So for the black hole state counting, you don't, am I correct that you don't really have an area anymore? You just have an area rescaled by the scalar field. So you find an entropy proportional to this rescaled area, or?
Yeah, in a sense, because in this minimal coupled setting, the entropy picks up scalar contribution on the horizon. So.
But is it that form that I can just think of it as in terms of the area, but with the...
I think it's just rescaled by the coupling, if I'm right. Do you know
so the entropy gets contribution, which is like 1 minus alpha phi squared.
Yeah, and this is just a conformal coupling.
Then basically, there's a little paradigm shift, because, I mean, in the standard treatment with no conformally coupled scalar field, you would say the macroscopic property of the black hole is its area, but here the invariant operator doesn't measure the area, but the area multiplied by the scalar field. So the property would be the area multiplied by the scalar field at the horizon, which you actually have as your microscopic scale.
Okay.
This is okay because, I mean, also from other treatments, we know that the entropy will depend on the scalar field at the horizon.
Okay.
I mean, it's.
Yeah.
So and open problems, at least in this setting, are that we still have no implementation on the dynamics on this level of observables. And you could also face problems with trying to give a functional Schrodinger equation, for example, on this space, because your clock variable is actually not a space-time scalar. So this was pointed out by Kukash. And if you want to use it for the functional Schrodinger equation, it could be necessary that you define a time function which takes exactly the same values as this d, but behaves like a space-time scalar. This, I think Kukash did this by also coupling something like a dust field to the original matter action, such that the values of the dust field exactly reproduce this clock variable. So, and another problem is the construction of spatially diffeomorphism invariant observables. This is still so far not settled in the setting of loop quantum gravity. And you have access to the state space, but the observables are a bit more tricky. And we haven't worked out anything new about that. And also interesting would be the extension to asymptotically flat situations, because they also have a canonical maximal time function. But here the problem is that you have to gauge fix the supertranslations, which come in as additional constraints. And so far it seems like they are not fixed by the conformal generator. But if you could do this, then probably the ADM energy could act as a natural generator of time evolution. But you would still have to map that to the d-observables with help of these projection maps. And another quite interesting question could be if you can extend this setting to supergravity scenarios. So this was the talk, and thank you.
We have 10 minutes according to the
program. Did you ever get concerned about the question I discussed about the possibility of change of sign?
Actually, this could be a problem, because if you look at the equations of motion of this conformally coupled field, then you see if this conformal coupling gets zero in a whole region of space-time, then actually there it could be that it looks like that your equation of motions for the metric variables are no longer well-defined. But yeah, so far we just treated this as a toy model for.
Right. I mean, we showed how it can be well defined in other gauges, and
yeah.
therefore, by making the appropriate map, we could study.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, it seems like since you are looking at the quantum version of this, it's a possible problem.
Yeah, for sure. So, but also one possibility could be, I mean, some additional slide for that, that you try to incorporate a minimal coupled scalar field and use this rescaling to the Jordan frame, where you actually transform the minimal coupled one into a conformally coupled one.
That's how you get there. Right.
Exactly.
So now everyone would think that you would get negative ground states if the sign changes and you're in a quantum theory.
Not necessarily negative ground states. Negative energy states, yes, but you can maintain unitarity. I think people seem to be familiar that this is the right way to do things. But if you have fields that have negative kinetic energy, the right thing about that is not that you lose unitarity. You should keep unitarity, and then the consequence is that you are going to get negative energies. You are going to get, you know, the energy spectrum is going to be bottomless.
Mm.
So that's the actual consequence. It's not that you are going to lose unitarity. But then that's something that needs to be discussed after that, because then you have to take into consideration the interactions and then see what happens.
If
you have a Hamilton which is not bounded from the orbit, the unitary evolution operator will be fine. So you can actually say that.
Well, but you see, the statement, this particular statement, can be made only for the free fields. You don't know the full answer with the interactions. So if you make that statement, you can make the statement at the level of the free fields.
The statement
I just made.
And in this context, it's not free, right? It's gravity coupled to...
but then you need to study the, you know, the thing is, how is it that you define your quantum theory?
Well, so, I mean, he claims to know, right? That's the talk.
That's why I asked you yesterday. No, but the naive claim that people want to make is that if this coefficient changes sign, then there will be tensor components of the metric that is going to come with negative energy. Of course, this is true. The Lagrangian shows you that this is true. But what is the consequence of that? The consequence is not that you're going to get that you're going to lose unitarity. That's not the actual consequence. You maintain unitarity at the free. When you look at the quantization at the field level. So it's very straightforward that you maintain unitarity, but then what the consequence of that kind of quantization where you maintain unitarity is that you're going to have a bottomless energy at the linearized level.
Well, the free level, you maintain unitarity because you have no scattering.
It's true, but your Hilbert space has all positive nodes. Okay.
I mean, what is the inner product? I thought the inner product would depend on the metric that appears in your action. And
that's the naive thing. This is what I'm saying. You know, we have to discuss this in more detail if you like. But having a negative kinetic term does not imply that we are going to use that metric when you do the quantization in order to maintain unitarity. You will maintain the symmetry of that, including the negative. You will maintain that, but there are no clear representations of that. It's just, you know, the Lorentz group. Take a harmonic oscillator like we have it in string theory, right? Harmonic oscillators with a time component as well.
Sure, that's why I have to go to Dick of 36, right?
But it's not the only way to quantize, okay? So, you know, I need to teach you guys this. Okay. It's not the only way to quantize. There are unitary. This is that way of quantization is non-unitary representations of the Lorentz group. When you take these oscillators and construct states on a vacuum, on a naive vacuum, you begin to construct non-unitary representations of the Lorentz field. That would be your spectrum would be classified according to non-unitary representations. This is only part of how you can attempt to quantize, and then you have losses. But there are also unitary representations of the Lorentz group that you can construct with the same set of oscillators. And this nobody seems to know. Okay? So I have a paper on that a few years ago. I welcome people to take a look at that. And the consequence of that is that you maintain unitarity. There is no issue with unitarity. The consequence is that you are going to have an energy spectrum that goes from minus infinity to plus infinity, and then you can begin to take a look at the consequences of that. So I mean, it's not the naive thing that everyone says, okay? It's there is a unitary version of this, and it's not ghosts. It's other issues that then you need to discuss those issues.
Okay, so so just two comments. I haven't done this in detail, but I expect the black hole entropy calculation with the dust time to go through in the physical setting, in the dust time gauge fixing. All you need to do is add a turn Simon's boundary term to the original action, and then proceed. Yes,
of course, but you would want to show that there is a black hole which is the solution of your dust action, dust bubble action, which has the necessary properties.
Yes, I think if you want to. Look at, we have numerical evidence at the moment. We don't have an exact solution. But the thing is that when you have an inner boundary projected onto a spatial surface, you impose a condition there. And that's the key thing to getting the counting. And so if you do that blindly, you will get exactly the same answer.
I mean, the same works also with the ones of Thomas Thiemann, and also easily by Lossky.
Yes. So, except they have, they don't really have a fully dynamical calculable Hamiltonian.
I mean, the Hamiltonian doesn't matter for the black hole state.
Well, actually, it should matter.
I mean, it doesn't matter as it's done now. So.
Because you're counting, you have to find black hole states, and you have to count those, and that's not been done in LQT in any sense. Why?
People might disagree. I mean, it's done all the time. If
you don't have the physical states of the theory, how can you say what is a black hole?
Of course, I mean, the argument is that there, I mean, for every horizon state, there should be an extension to a state in the body which
But then you can do that in lots of theories.
Of course, and then you go, for example, the parameterized model, the reverse, or like the others, and you say, physical states.
So all I'm saying
I think it's the conformal coupling, so here it would be A of phi, so it's 1 minus.
And that's the key point, really. So to say that, you know, you can do it in shape dynamics or model error, model B, or model 29.
And this is absorbed in the alpha somehow. I think there's one. Yeah, should be one over 16 pi g or something.
Oh, okay. So that
I one minus.
Sorry. I want to go back to
the point that you were trying to raise here. There was something I learned from Chris Eichmann a long time ago, 10 years ago. So I didn't pay too much attention to it at the time when I should have. It had to do with real-time thermal field theory. This idea that if you appropriately pick your contour, so when you quantize, you actually do perturbative quantization, and you look at your Green's function, instead of using, you take a contour around the real-time axis, and you double your field theory to have negative kinetic energy terms. So you have positive, and then you double the negative kinetic energy term, and you turn on interactions. And when you properly diagonalize your Green's function in the path integral, including both, you find that the interaction terms give you thermality in a real-time sense. So I think that's an example where you actually have negative kinetic energy states in the sense that your harmonic oscillators, when you quantize a scalar field, a negative, the propagated is corresponding to negative kinetic energy. But the proper interpretation there is that when you turn on interactions, you actually see in real time how thermal effects occur. Am I missing something? Is anyone
well,
here?
You need more than just to go back, right? You need,
you need to come back down.
You need to go down and to connect.
It's
state physics, right?
What?
There's nothing strange in there.
I'm just saying that's an example where you have negative kinetic energy states in your path loop.
No, I think that's not the right interpretation.
No, what I'm saying is that there are quantum states for the same system, relativistic harmonic oscillator, that are completely orthogonal to the ones that people suggest that the Hilbert space for which there are ghosts. Okay, there is the naive Hilbert space, that the version that is done in string theory. Okay, that is to begin with non-unitary, and then if you have appropriate constraints, you can remove the ghosts. Okay, there is that version. And there is a completely orthogonal Hilbert space to that, completely orthogonal, which is completely unitary.
Does this give a consistent string theory dimension different than
you have to study string theory to see what it does. It begins to give you an infinite number of tachyons. So certainly that's part of the equations, but then you may choose not to include it as part of your definition of string theory. But it is a complete orthogonal field space which is there for the relativistic and the possible. So I have a very detailed paper a few years back. You can take a look, or I can explain it for those who are interested.
From a physical point of view, this infinite ladder going down might run into trouble if there was a teeny tiny perturbation from somewhere which wanted to take all your energy down to infinity. That's the direct equation before the filling up the sea.
Yeah, but I mean, what I suggested from the solution, the classical solutions that we had, including this sector. Now, we did not study what happens to these perturbations, but our solution suggested that the moment you enter this anti-gravity regime, then because of this negative energy states for the gravitons, then of course you will begin to emit. I mean, the interactions we want to emit all sorts of negative energy gravitons because you have a bottomless pit, right? So you have to do that. But on the other hand, there is the zero energy constraint in relativity, which then requires that you have to balance that immediately with positive energy matter radiation. So at that moment, then our equations have to be changed. Immediately they have to be changed because there was a radiation parameter that we were keeping constant. So the moment you increase radiation, then the duration of this anti-gravity regime becomes small. So there is a fight that has to happen. So the dynamics is going to decide what actually is going to happen. And it should be an interesting consequence to find out what that is. Presumably the unitarity will be maintained. But then what is the actual physics that's going to happen? Well, I doubt that we would get an answer, a full answer to that, just by studying standard gravity. So probably we need something more sophisticated, maybe string theory, maybe some other version of quantum gravity to get the real true answer to what happens. But this is an effect which is there. It is required by the geodesic incompleteness that you must, if the moment you try to do to complete the geodesics of gravity. So the moment you construct a theory which is geodesically complete, then you have this effect. So and it goes model independent, etc. So it's something to be studied. And you cannot give a very naive answer to it. So
okay, so on that note, let's thank Andrew. We made it.